Welcome to Social Justice Matters, a podcast from Social Justice Ireland. Budget 2020 betrayed the vulnerable as many were left further behind. Less than 24 hours after Minister Donoghue stood up on the Dáil to deliver his budget speech, we published the first full and comprehensive analysis of Budget 2020. What follows is the audio from our Budget 2020 analysis seminar. We hope you enjoy it.
Okay, so thank you very, very much to everybody who has come out today to our post-budget 2020 seminar. You're very welcome. You're also very welcome to those of you who are live streaming this event on our website. I just want to double check that everybody has their hard copy of the publication. If not, more are available just at the door there. My name is Colette Bennett. I am a research and policy analyst with Social Justice Ireland. To my right is Sean Healy, who many of you I'm sure know already, our CEO. To my left is Eamon Murphy, economic and social analyst. And to his left is Michelle Murphy, research and policy analyst. So I'm now going to hand you over to Eamon Murphy, who's going to start off with a look at the overview of the revenue and expenditures. They're in the middle of the document on pages 12 and 13. Eamon.
Thanks, Colette. So the purpose of this page is, amongst other things, to situate the individual budget lines within the context of the overall expenditure and revenue raising. If people are listening to Minister Donoghue talking about 10 million for X fund and 20 million in funding for something else, it's probably important to realise what the overall expenditure is in the various areas and where a lot of the money that is used to fund that comes from. So that's the purpose of the pie charts and the pieces of information underneath, to give people an understanding of where it is the money comes from and where it's going. As you can see from the page on the left, on page 12, roughly half of all the revenue raised by the government in each year comes through income tax and VAT. People will be well aware at this stage that our reliance on corporation tax has grown over the last few years. The figure used to be less than half of that. And at the bottom, we have some handy indicators as to what's happening to that revenue, in which areas it's grown by the most. Same goes for the page on the right, on page 13. And as you can see there, approximately half of all government expenditure goes on the areas of social protection and health. And as you can see at the bottom left-hand corner, health has been the area of most growth in the last 12 months. We're expecting to spend an extra $1.3 billion in 2020 in that area. And on the same topic, I suppose, of contextualising Budget 2020, pages 20 and 21 contain a couple of tables setting out the context in which Minister Donoghue stood up in the Dáil yesterday to make his promises to us for the next 12 months. I'm not going to go through each one of them individually, you'll be glad to know, but if the ones I'd like to draw your attention to are, first of all, in the top left-hand corner in relation to population. As you can see there on lines 2 and 3, the percentage of the population that's made up of older people, those over 65 and those over the age of 80, is set to grow significantly between the last census in 2016 and 2036. In the case of those over the age of 80, it's set to more than double. The reason we keep drawing attention to this every year is because we don't believe that the government is doing enough to prepare for this growth in that particular area. That's going to involve a lot more investment in primary care centres, in home care packages, and all the supports that are going to be required in order to help older people live independent lives, preferably in their own homes. To the right of that is a quick synopsis of the situation with regard to housing and homelessness. Again, nobody here is going to be surprised to hear that, or everybody will be aware that homelessness has grown significantly over the last few years. What I've done here, we change this up every year to show the different growth rates, but what we're looking at here is contextualising it in what the situation was in December 2014. And the less than 5 years since, adult homelessness has more than doubled, child homelessness has more than quadrupled. And I think if you compare that to the situation underneath, when we look at the labour market situation, you probably won't find a better indicator of how this has been a recovery in some areas and then not at all in others. A recovery for many people, yes, and jobs growth over the last few years has been probably the great good news story of that period, but there's a significant proportion of people who are not benefiting at all from the Irish recovery. And the government is always at pains to stress what a good job they're doing in relation to employment, and they have overseen significant jobs growth in the last 5 or 6 years. But they've also overseen a growth in homelessness at an even greater rate than that. So the other area that I think is of interest is on the left side of that column. We've got some interesting numbers in relation to income poverty and inequality. So some information on what constitutes a poverty line for various different households, what the numbers of people living in poverty are, and a comparison between the urban and rural situation this time as regards poverty rates and deprivation rates. So what you can clearly see is that there's a significant urban-rural divide, and you can see at the bottom of the left column the extent to which income differs in Dublin versus, say, the border region, which is the area of Ireland, the Nuts 3 region, which is furthest behind in that regard. So what we've seen as well in this recovery is a growth in the differences between, depending on which cohorts you want to look at, whether it would be those people who are in employment versus those who are homelessness, or those who are living in urban versus rural settings, those living in the capital where the vast majority of resources and jobs are concentrated versus those in less fortunate areas. So this is the context in which Minister Donoghue stood up yesterday to deliver his speech. He talked about the need to look after certain people and certain areas and certain groups in the event of a disorderly Brexit. We would be arguing that he ignored a lot of the people who we should have been focusing on. Page 21 is an extract of some of the macroeconomic numbers from the Department of Finance's literature yesterday. So just some useful numbers for people to know as regards what the GDP amounts are versus the GNI star. GNI star is what we believe to be a much more accurate reflection of Ireland's national income. What I found interesting was the under the national income section, lines 4 and 5, those projected GDP and GNP growth figures over the next few years are significantly down on previous ones, and is probably a reflection of the department's assumption that there may well be a no deal Brexit, if not at the end of this month, then in a few months' time. Under the Exchequer budgetary position, towards the bottom of that, we highlight the debt to GDP and debt to GNI figures in 2020. And this is a reminder that despite the progress we've made economically, these are still very large numbers and kind of in unsafe territory. Over to the right, we've included the taxation numbers, but there's no changes here at all, really, as people will be aware from yesterday. It was steady as we go on that, and I'll talk more about that in the taxation section in a moment. But these two tables, hopefully people will find useful, along with pages 12 and 13, as regards contextualising Budget 2020. On pages 10 and the top of pages 11, sorry, pages on page 10 and the top of page 11, we review the major taxation moves that were made in Budget 2020 yesterday. As usual, we situate the context of the taxation section in the fact that Ireland's overall tax take is far too low to be able to deliver the public services, the social infrastructure that would be expected in most developed Western European economies. We've got a series of crises and deficits in Ireland in areas most people are familiar with, housing and health, but also in education, in rural broadband, transport, and as regards our environmental obligations. And it would be foolish to believe that we could close the gap between where we are now and where we should be, or where we are and where our European counterparts are, by continuing to collect an overall tax take that is far below the European average, regardless of how that's measured. And we've looked at it from a number of different angles, whether it be for per capita or as a ratio of national income. Either way, Ireland is collecting far too little as regards taxation. So our budget submission, which was released in June, very much focused on the need to widen the tax base to make it more stable and to gradually increase the tax base over a number of years, the overall tax take over a number of years, to reach a point where we should be. What we saw yesterday, there wasn't a whole lot in the way of movement in the right direction. We very much welcome the increase in stamp duty on non-residential property. That's something we called for in our budget submission. And experience has shown that you can raise a reasonably significant amount of money at that with no discernible impact on the economy at all. We were very pleased to see some anti-tax avoidance measures brought in as well by the minister. And we're happy to see that whereas the increase in carbon tax was below what was anticipated, that money is going to be ring-fenced to deal with climate change and environmental issues. So that's very positive. That's something that you don't see very often from the Department of Finance. So we welcome that. As regards income tax, we've highlighted the two major ones at the top of that particular section on the left. So there was an increase in the home care tax and in the earned income tax credit. But as the minister indicated a few weeks ago, there was no significant changes to the income tax section. This is something that we would welcome. We do believe that there was a better way to use the resources than to give back a couple of euros to people in the budget. But generally speaking, it was a disappointing budget from a taxation perspective. The Help to Buy scheme was retained for a couple more years. Colette will address that in more detail later. Things like SARP were maintained, despite the fact that we don't believe there's much of an economic argument for them. And I suppose the main thing we'd be saying about the taxation section is that while there were some small increases, it doesn't come even close to the amount that's needed to tackle some of the issues I referred to earlier. We called for PAYE and personal tax credits to be made refundable in our budget submission, and for discretionary tax reliefs to be standard rated. This would have given the government the power to tackle low pay and poverty amongst working people on low incomes. Would have given them a way to raise an extra almost half a billion euros, by what we would imagine by doing very little to upset any economic activity. And there was no move to properly tax empty houses or underdeveloped land either, which is something that boggles the mind at this point, given the situation we're in with the housing crisis. I guess the thrust of the taxation measures were towards supporting business and the better off. And, unfortunately, they're going to do very little to assist the less well-off, which is the area that we believe that the measures in this particular budget, given that it is so-called Brexit budget, that the resources would have been better directed towards the vulnerable to the lower paid. But business and enterprise seems to have been the focus of it from a taxation point of view. The last page I'm going to look at is page 24, which is the actual back page. In our budget submission, we called for greater scrutiny of tax expenditures, or better known to most people as tax reliefs or tax breaks. Essentially, these are policy instruments whereby the government allows certain individuals to reduce their tax liability, assuming they follow certain behaviours or invest in certain activities. Now, these are usually politically quite popular tools. They don't increase direct government expenditure, so people often overlook them. But because of that, but because they reduce the tax liability of certain individuals, they represent revenue forgone. And in this particular instance, in Ireland's instance, they represent quite a significant amount of revenue being foregone, approximately 10% of the total tax take every year, which is, depending on where we are, equates to around 7 to 8 billion euros. You'd imagine, given that being the case, that there'd be sufficient scrutiny as part of the budgetary process, but that's not the case at all. In fact, 23% of these reliefs have never been reviewed at all, according to the Parliamentary Budget Office. And you'd imagine that as part of the budgetary process, again, you would see a publication of some of the previous costs of these reliefs, projected future costs, and an opportunity to debate these in the Dáil to see if they're still fit for purpose, or whether there's a better way of encouraging the activity that they're supposed to encourage. Extraordinarily, this is not the case, and that's amazing given how much money is actually involved in it. We would have called in the past for a sunset clause to be part of every single tax relief, so that would have to be proactively be reviewed and renewed at a particular date, but only 13% of tax reliefs have that sunset clause. So another way of looking at it, 87% of all tax reliefs are going on indefinitely without any review. We believe that as part of the budgetary process, there should be greater scrutiny of these, given that there would be an opportunity, if some of these were to be removed, to raise several hundred million, if not several billion, in a single year. And given that the minister has contextualised this budget by saying we're quite scarce in resources, we find it strange that this wasn't considered in Budget 2020. And the final thing we're going to look at is on page 17. It's a quick summary of the public finance position for this year, or sorry, I beg your pardon, the coming year and for the 2 years after that. Again, I'm not going to go through this table except to point out that it's there. It's a useful piece of information, hopefully, for some people to check out current and capital budget balances and the overall general government balance. What I will address, though, is the section just on the right of that page, which is the overseas aid budget. This was something we kind of hummed and hawed as to how to react to. I mean, we were anticipating possibly no increase in that at all, or maybe something in the region of 10 million euros. They increased it by 20, so that was something of a positive. And that amount, the overall amount, the 837 million to overseas development assistance, as a proportion of national income, as a proportion of GNI Star, has increased by a very small amount. So that's positive, and there was also an increase in the contribution to the Green Climate Fund. On the downside, if the government is serious about actually moving that figure in the direction of the UN-agreed target of 0.7% of national income, they're saying by 2030 we had hoped for a more ambitious target. But if they are serious about moving it in that direction, then that amount should have been significantly higher. So in some ways, we welcome the fact that there's been no fall behind in where we stood as regards the national income position. In other ways, we would call on the Department of Foreign Affairs to renew their focus on that and to publish a roadmap for, if it needs to be 2030, then so be it. But to publish a roadmap on how we're going to get there, which would add a certain amount of certainty for the sector that are delivering that's delivering that aid in some of the poorest countries in the world. At uncertain economic times, we believe that it's important to remember to protect the vulnerable. We talked about that in other aspects of this budget, and Sean, Michelle and Colette will address that in more detail. But ODA is has a major role to play in that approach of protecting the vulnerable. That's particularly the case given that the majority of Ireland's overseas development aid is spent in countries that are feeling the brunt of climate change, which is something that we, as everybody knows now, are a prime offender in. So I think it's only right that be a focus of this budget. So that's my section completed. I will pass you back over to Colette now, and she's going to begin with housing, I believe.
Housing on page 5, yeah. Yes. Thank you very much, Eamon. Yes, I mean, Eamon pointed out in terms of the numbers around housing and homelessness, you know, there is an unacceptable rise in homeless adults, homeless families, and has been since 2014. In terms of emergency accommodation spending, last year alone there was over 147 million spent on emergency accommodation. That's 402,000 a day. That's the cost of a reasonably good house somewhere in the middle of Dublin. It's not sustainable to pay this kind of money on emergency accommodation when we are paying so little in respect of prevention. What is needed is preventative measures for families who are at risk of homelessness, and for housing first principles to apply to families who are experiencing homelessness, so that they get into a sustainable home with wraparound services. Those wraparound services need to look at things like physical therapy for their children who have no space to learn how to walk or to crawl. They need speech therapy. They need counselling. They need to look at things like transport in and around housing to make sure that it is viable in terms of accessing the labour market, in terms of accessing schools and childcare, for what it's worth, that's there. In terms of actually building social housing, we've been in decline at the moment. The first couple of years of Rebuilding Ireland, from a very low target base, we exceeded our targets. Since 2017, we haven't. We haven't exceeded the build targets. And the build targets for local authorities now include turnkey that are bought. So, you know, we're grossly failing a numerous number of families and single adults in this market. And just to concentrate on single adult households, there is a lot of conversation around family homelessness and families on the waiting list. And that, of course, is a concern. There will be generations who will be affected by the housing and homelessness crisis in this country. But to look at single adult households, for the waiting list that was published last year, Of the 71,848 households on the waiting list, 77% of those are single adult households. Now, when you consider what is currently being thought of as an affordable home, so 300 to 320,000 euro, that is just out of reach of these. You have to earn between 77,000 and 82,000 a year to make that. There are very few single adult households that are able to reach that threshold. Of course, the private rented subsidy, that is the housing assistance payment, has exceeded its targets every year of Rebuilding Ireland. It's flying. And it, you know, this year alone, in the first 6 months, it exceeded its target by 10%. You know, we're going entirely in the wrong direction when we look at housing as a social construct and as a social good. In terms of our tenants, yes, you know, one in seven of us are living in private rented accommodation. You know, there have been some moves in relation to legislation that was introduced in just before the summer this year around the Residential Tenancies Act in terms of, you know, tenant protections. However, there hasn't been enough, and we're still looking at, you know, the introduction of co-living, or still considering the introduction of these kind of co-living arrangements. I mean, you know, we're gone back to the generation of tenements. How can it be possible that my children and their children will grow up in the tenements that my grandparents grew up in? So in terms of what that allocation for the Residential Tenancies Board was actually intended to do, it's to enforce the rent pressure zone legislation. That's a good thing. Absolutely, we support that and we welcome that. There should be caps on rents. It is completely unaffordable. It has been rising for the last 27 consecutive quarters. However, more is urgently needed. The level of rental inspections is grossly inadequate, and funding needs to be channeled there to make sure that, yes, tenancies are affordable, but also that the accommodation that these tenants are living in is actually viable, is healthy, and is appropriate for them and their needs. In terms of the Help to Buy, the last piece on this page, we were very disappointed to note that this has been extended for a further 2 years with no changes whatsoever. I mean, this is subsidising house price inflation. The Parliamentary Budget Office have done some analysis on this in the last couple of weeks, and they are, you know, their analysis supports what we have been saying about this, that this really is a subsidy for those who can afford significant deposits to buy houses at the higher end of the market. In order to fund mortgages for those houses, you have to earn high incomes. So the subsidies are being directed in the wrong place. This is not a progressive subsidy in any way, shape or form, because it is benefiting those who don't actually need it the most. In terms then of the next investment package that I'm going to talk about is education, and that's on page 11. So we know, and Eamon referred to it earlier on in terms of demography, we are an expanding population. So that, you know, that puts pressure on all aspects of the education system, from, you know, early years to lifelong learning opportunities. In terms of what the budget did deliver, yes, it did deliver for children with special needs. So 150 additional teachers, 1,000 additional SNAs, special needs assistants, 400 additional special education teaching posts, and 1,300 new special class places. That is absolutely welcome. We also welcome the increase in the National Training Fund and the additional school transport scheme allocation. However, you know, additional resources were not made available to increase the pupil-teacher ratio. We have a fairly high, above-average pupil-teacher ratio. We also have below-average participation rate in lifelong learning, and they're areas that were not addressed in this budget. There was no increase for funding for DESH schools in more disadvantaged areas. There was no additional investment in higher education and further education, particularly, again, to support those from disadvantaged disadvantaged areas to avail of opportunities in higher education. It is unacceptable that our Minister for Education would suggest that people in rural areas who cannot afford high costs in terms of transport or in terms of funding should just make do with what's available to them in their local region. Everybody deserves access and opportunity to quality education. Quality education is absolutely transformative, particularly for those who are in disadvantaged areas. It provides access to opportunities that wouldn't otherwise be available to them, and this budget has done nothing to progress their lot. The next section I'm going to look at is social protection, and that's on page 14. So social welfare, as we know, is the main way that we reduce our poverty. Without social transfers, we would have a poverty rate of just under 44%, 43.8%. That is an indictment of how unequal, our income distribution system actually is. And our social transfers is a very progressive measure. Notwithstanding that, 15.7%, so 760,000 people still live in poverty. 230,000 children still live in poverty. We have a significant distance to go in terms of our national reform programme targets to reduce the consistent poverty rate by 2% and lift 70,000 children out of consistent poverty. In Budget 2020, all of the primary social welfare rates were left the same. I do have some piece to show you in relation to what the social welfare rates look like pre and post budget 2020, and it is not very interesting reading because there's an awful lot of zeros in terms of the changes. Yes, it equalised job seekers' rates for those aged 25, and it made some measures in certain circumstances to equalise the rates for those aged between 18 and 25. 18 and 24. There were welcome increases in the fuel allowance, one of the largest increases in the last number of years, and an increase in the working family payment income thresholds. We welcome all of that. Of course, we do. However, we regret that the primary rates weren't increased. You know, when we launched our budget choices back in June, we advocated for a €9 increase to build on the steps taken in previous budgets and to address income inequalities. This just was not done. Nothing was addressed there. The current rates are completely insufficient, particularly when you look at them in proportion to average earnings. We regret that the state pension wasn't increased. Again, we advocated for a €9 increase there that would work towards our commitments under the roadmap for pensions, and nothing was done. We also regret that the budget did nothing in relation to a cost of disability payment for those who are living with disability. We know that persons with disability have a higher poverty rate. We know that they are less likely to be participating in employment. We know that when they are trying to access employment, that they have difficulties in terms of discrimination. This budget has done very little in terms of supporting those families and those people. As I said, for those of you who may wish to have a look at it, and I don't intend to go through it in very much detail, not that there's very much detail in it, on pages 18 and 19, we show, as we always do, the changes in social welfare rates. You'll see from the fourth column down, there are an awful lot of zeros. There has been very, very little change. Yes, the acknowledgement is there in relation to the equalisation of the rate for those aged 25, but apart from that, there's very little done. In terms of then work, unemployment and job creation, on page 15, there have been some positive trends, and again Eamon pointed those out in his overall context piece earlier on. We've experienced our 28th consecutive quarter of employment growth. That's fantastic. However, we still have persistent and pervasive inequalities, particularly for people living with a disability, for older workers, particularly those in at-risk groups in terms of automation and globalisation, and workers in rural areas. We welcomed the Department of Business, Enterprise and Innovation, the increase that they received of 2% on last year. We've welcomed the increased earned income tax credit availed up by the self-employed and the increase in the one-parent family payment disregard and the working family payment disregard. However, again, no move was made in relation to the national minimum wage. Again, the poorest and most vulnerable are being left behind. There was no signalled increase, notwithstanding the fact that the living wage is currently 20% above the rate of the national minimum wage. It currently stands at €12.30. The government did identify and clearly have identified jobs that will be at risk post-Brexit. They've allocated £45 million for a social welfare fund. If they have identified those jobs, they have done very little to promote the support for those jobs, to promote them actually becoming more sustainable and supporting those particularly older workers in at-risk sectors. And finally for me, because I see Sean looking at his watch, onto the healthcare section on page 16. We know our population is ageing and it's increasing, and all of that comes with, you know, an additional pressure on healthcare. You know, in the context in terms of our ageing populations, we will see a significant increase in the next number of years. However, at current rates, we have one in five people aged 65 and over on waiting lists, on the waiting list, are waiting over 18 months. In terms of children, one in five of those on the waiting list for outpatients appointment are waiting over 18 months. This is unacceptable, particularly when it comes to waiting lists for services that are needed and that are age dependent. In the budget, we welcome the increase of $97 million for older persons, including the 1 million additional home care hours. Unfortunately, the 1 million additional home care hours isn't even half of what's needed for the waiting list at the current rate of provision, which is grossly inadequate at an average of about 6.3 hours a week. We welcomed the $25 million additional for disability services and the $53 million for measures including prescription or reduced prescription charges, the increased medical card income limits for those aged 70 and over, the reduced thresholds for the drugs repayment scheme and the free GP care extended to under 8s and the free dental for those under 6. However, you know, again, there is a huge lack of transparency in the health budget here. The numbers just don't stack up. We suspect, but although we don't know because the clarity has not been provided, that the measures that have been identified as being increases will come at a cost to existing levels of service. Existing level of services are already poor. We cannot take any more cuts in this. In terms of provision for primary care, again, that is grossly inadequate. The investment for primary care, the upfront infrastructural investment in primary care under Sláinte Care was to be $3 billion over 5 years. That just hasn't happened. We're still waiting. There is still a lack of inadequate funding in terms of primary care teams and no real primary care networks. With that, I'm going to hand you over to Michelle Murphy. Thank you.
Thank you, Colette. So I'm going to look at the impacts on some of the households, the income gains, and then a few of the other packages from the budget. So I'll start on pages 6 and 7. So you have some charts on page 6 outlining the impact of tax and headline welfare changes and then effective income tax rates. So in terms of income gains there, you see on the chart there's a slight increase for people who are unemployed, but this actually just reflects the full year effect of the 5 euro increase in budget 2019 and the 100% Christmas bonus payment. So it's not actually an increase that was introduced in budget 2020. It's important to bear in mind that these calculations don't take into account changes to secondary benefits or indirect taxes because they don't flow to every household equally. I suppose one thing to point out when we're talking about a Brexit budget, in September, TDs benefited from an annual increase of about €30 a week in their income. And from October next year, they'll get a gross increase of about 70 euros a week. Yet those on the lowest incomes, those people on the national minimum wage, didn't get their proposed increase. And those on social welfare rates didn't receive an increase. So I suppose that just outlines perhaps some of the priorities that are evident from this budget. In terms of effective income tax rates, what I want to say here is that if you look at earners on 30,000, 40,000, 60,000, 120,000, 20 years ago, every single one of those people or couples with one earner or two earners had a higher effective tax rate in the year 2000 than they do today. So that's just something to point out in the context of a narrative that consistently supplies the allegation that is incorrect, that we our income tax rates are incredibly high. We're one of the highest taxes on incomes. We don't. 20 years ago, people were paying a higher effective income tax rate than they are today. That's the reality, and those are the facts. Eamon referred to it earlier, that our overall tax take remains too low. We do welcome the increase in the stamp duty on non-residential property, but there were not moves to broaden the base overall and increase the tax take. We have researched and proposed a new target, which is outlined there, which we argue that Ireland's overall level of taxation should reach a level equivalent to 15,000 euros per capita in 2017 terms, increasing each year in line with GNI Star. If we had followed this path, then we would raise an average of 3.2 billion between 2018 to 2020. So that just shows what a small overall increase in the tax take can mean in terms of the amount of resources that are available for investment. On page 8, then, we look at the impact of tax and benefit changes over the lifetime of this government. So this is the cumulative impact over a series of years. So we look at welfare-dependent households and households with jobs. So they're spread across all areas of society. Single households, couples, people on the minimum wage, the living wage, people on a pension, with and without children. So I suppose the key thing to point out here is that overall, the choices made over this period have given the least to single welfare-dependent households and households on the lowest earnings. The gains that have flowed primarily have flowed to the households on the highest income. So that's just something to point out, which tracks the analysis over time. On page 9, we have a series of issues here. Now, some of them have been referred to already. So Colette already mentioned the minimum wage and our regret that the increase has been deferred. I think it's important to point out that one in five workers in Ireland are on low pay, and there'll be a gap between of €2.50 between the minimum wage and the living wage. It's something we keep pointing out. And so, you know, those on the minimum wage lost out in this budget. In terms of older people, Colette also pointed out, and Eamon as well, the projected increase in this group. While we do welcome the increase in the living alone allowance, the fuel allowance, the budget overall and government has taken very limited steps to commence planning for the future health and care needs for this group, which are unavoidable and will be significant in the years to come. Disability has already been referred to. Just the one thing we would like to reiterate is that no steps were taken in this budget to introduce a cost of disability payment, despite last year the government commissioning a study on the cost of disability. So it's incredibly disappointing that this group cohort, which are at very high risk of poverty, which are excluded from the labour market, were more or less ignored in the budget. On the issue of taxation, I suppose one thing we point out every year is the issue of corporate tax. And Eamon mentioned how the proportion of our revenue that corporation tax makes up and how this has been growing year on year. And the 2016 report from the Controller and Auditor General found an effective corporate tax rate of 9.8%. which highlights significant room for improvement if our headline rate is 12.5%. We proposed a minimum effective corporate tax rate of 6% in our budget. We've proposed this for many, many years. We are very disappointed not to see any movement towards this rate in budget 2020. It's inevitable as we move towards the OECD BEPS process and the European Commission consolidated corporate tax base. Minimum effective corporate tax rate is inevitable, and we need to get ahead of this. Now, in terms of sustainability and the environment, Budget 2020 made some welcome changes in terms of the carbon tax, which we note has been referred to as carbon pricing. But overall, it didn't do anything about carbon policy itself. Yes, we welcome the ring fencing of the carbon tax increase, as Eamon pointed out, but in no way was it a green budget. Bold and new decisions were referred to meet the defining challenge of our time, and not a single bold or new decision was taken. We pointed out that you could have a half a billion sustainability package, and we pointed out how you might fund it, investing in things like a just transition, a national retrofitting programme, biodiversity, our National Parks and Wildlife Service, renewable energy. None of these things were adequately resourced in the budget. Simple decisions you could take, like a levy on single-use coffee cups, an aggregate levy, a commercial air transport tax, absolutely no movement. So what we have is not every sector is actually making a contribution to us meeting our emissions reductions. And there was absolutely no progress on examining the subsidies that the CSO has pointed out as potentially environmentally damaging, which equate to about 4 billion euros a year. At the very least, we should have had a commitment from the government to report the Oireachtas on these subsidies. In terms of rural Ireland, much has been made about rural Ireland being the heartbeat of our economy. And yes, the Brexit fund targeting certain areas is welcome, but a significant proportion of the funding is contingent on a no-deal Brexit. And we must remember that regardless of Brexit, rural Ireland has needed and will continue to need investment to deal with things such as adapting to a low-carbon economy, adapting to the challenges of new technologies and the impact that these will have on employment, adapting to ageing. Yet we didn't see the investment in areas such as broadband, which is crucial to diversify the rural economy, in things like public transport to enable people to make behavioural changes as a result of the carbon taxes and the increased cost that will bring to households. So in reality, we didn't really see the investment that we would have hoped to see in rural Ireland. And, you know, it was quite disappointing in that regard. And I think focusing on the Brexit fund misses the point that the other areas that need significant investment did not feature in this budget. So finally, I'm going to end on page three, looking at three particular issues. So the first one is children and child poverty. You know, this was heralded as a budget to reduce the cost of living for families and to reduce child poverty. And yes, there were some welcome initiatives for children and families, but the combined effect of these measures is very small relative to the challenge that we face. As Colette mentioned, there's one in five children in this country who are in poverty. So they're living in families who have incomes below the poverty line. Over 110,000 of them are living in consistent poverty, so they're experiencing deprivation and they're living in a low-income household. The budget didn't do enough to address this. You know, this is a significant challenge, and the way you meet that challenge is you focus on adult welfare rates, decent pay and working conditions for parents who are in work. We didn't see this. We saw some small increases. There was an announcement on the National Childcare Scheme of funding for 54 million euros, but the detail as yet is not available. And what's important to remember is when the detail becomes available, have we ironed out those issues where lone parent families will potentially lose out with the amalgamation of schemes? And the other thing to remember is increasing subsidies won't actually increase the number of places that are available or deal with the issues of low pay in the childcare sector. So we have a bigger issue. And as a society, we need to substantially invest in our children and families and in their education and care. And we made very limited progress on this in the budget. In terms of welfare, it's already been highlighted. Yes, there were small increases in particular payments, which we welcome, but overall, those on the lowest incomes lost out. We asked for a €9 increase in welfare payments so that they would keep pace with the benchmark of 27.5% of average earnings. This wasn't forthcoming. Now, 27.5% of average earnings is not a lot of money. It's just over €11,000 a year. So those people on social welfare payments are going to be left behind. And what we already know is that unless welfare increases keep track with increases elsewhere in the economy, the weakest and the most vulnerable get left behind, and they never make up that ground into the future. Budget 2020 largely ignored the welfare system, which means that it largely ignored the living standards and the needs of the weakest in our society. So in that regard, it's disappointing. As Colette noted, we do welcome the limited change to the increase in job seekers payments for young people, and we would hope that in the next budget they will bring all young people up to the adult rate. And finally, as I referenced before, the carbon tax. We do welcome the increase. We believe it doesn't go far enough. It's going to raise 90 million. If you'd done it by 10 euros a tonne, you would have 212 million to put into your Just Transition Fund. We welcome the ring fencing piece. We welcome a Just Transition Commissioner and the commitment to engage with local communities as to how you're going to manage the change at the local level. But overall, you need significantly more investment to really deal with this transition. And we will look at interest in terms of the Midlands Transition Fund, how that should be replicated. It's important to remember that that fund is targeted and focused on a specific area and a specific type of employment. So we have to look at overall on a regional level how you might move towards a just transition. But overall, in terms of sustainability in the environment, the budget was disappointing. I'll hand over to Sean now to conclude.
So maybe the next thing we could look at is page four on the whole issue of Brexit. The Brexit seemed to be at the centre in a great many ways of the budget. The minister made something like 37 or 38 references to Brexit in his actual speech. What is of major interest to us would be the fact that he missed some of the most important things on Brexit, despite all the guff that he went on with. What you need to think in terms of is what Brexit will do. One of the things that will happen is that there will be a substantial rise in consumer prices. And there's been an ESRI study to show what that cost of would average out at for households. Average Irish households the Brexit thing will cost them about anything from €892 to €1,360 a year. But that this increase is very unevenly distributed across households, and lower income households in particular, they spend a higher proportion of their money on basic goods like food. And it's quite interesting that identified clearly that among the products identified as most prone to price increases, food expenditure is the category most exposed. So food is likely to go up more than any other as a result of Brexit. On that chart, on chart 4.1 on page 4, you see the impact of the food increases, because what we're looking at there is the proportion of their budget households across the whole income distribution in the society actually spend on food. And what you find is the poorest 30%, the three deciles to the left, they spend far more on food in terms of a proportion of their income. They spend far more of their income on food than others do, particularly higher income. And that's obviously, that's obvious that that would be the case, yet that will mean in effect that when Brexit comes, the people who will be hit hardest are the poorest, who are also the people with the least capacity to actually deal with this. And these are also the one group that is completely ignored in the budget. There is a very substantial number of people who are among the poorest in society who gain nothing as a result of the budget, but will be hit one way or another as a result of Brexit. And I think that what the government needs to widen its consideration of those who should be who they consider to be impacted by Brexit, hard or otherwise Brexit. They seem to not understand or even grasp in any way that the poorest people in society will be among those most impacted when Brexit arrives, whether that's a hard or a soft Brexit. And that if we get that type of hard Brexit in particular, low-income households will need support to absorb the living cost increases they will inevitably face. I would pay very serious attention to the failure of government in this particular area. Moving on, I want to move on to page 23 and look at the whole area of more local, if you like, public participation networks, and people will understand that Social Justice Ireland has and is a key stakeholder in the development of public participation networks across the country. There are now PPNs across the whole country, public participation networks in all 31 local authorities, more than 15,000 local community voluntary environmental and social inclusion organisations are involved in those, and they are looking at the budget, and we are looking at the budget in, from their perspective, if you like. And of interest will be some of the allocations that have been improved: library development, the peace programme, community services programme, SICAP, a number of others, including the recently launched strategy for community and voluntary sector, and the social enterprise and rural policies. They also got some money. But I think while these additional allocations are welcome, they represent only a fraction of what is needed. And what we have presented there are some of the key kinds of areas of local authority budgeting, and what we've kind of identified. I'm not going to go through all the areas, but we looked at health, economy and resources, looked at social and community development, participation, democracy and good governance, values, culture and meaning, and environment and sustainability. These are six kind of key areas for policy. And what we look at, when you look at them, the actual changes are minimal. Now, they're already seriously under-resourced, and as a result, I think we'd be disappointed. And PPNs, public participation networks, will be disappointed at the moderate increases, and which will in effect mean that they will still struggle to meet demand. Moving on to the story at the end of the Sustainable Development Goals, Ireland continues to lag on the Sustainable Development Goals. We are a laggard, not just on climate, but we're a laggard across all the various goals. You will recall that the 17 Sustainable Development Goals have been put in place by the United Nations. There are a whole range of indicators, and Social Justice Ireland publishes an annual report on those and how Ireland is doing compared to its peers. And we identify its peers as the 14 other countries with ourselves in the EU 15. And these would have similar standards of living, similar income levels and so on. And what that found, the most across the system, it has found that Ireland is always in the bottom half in terms of performance. And when you break it down into economic or environmental, social inclusion, you find that Ireland is always in the bottom half, if not in the bottom third of those. In fact, Ireland is currently ranked 11th out of the 15 overall when you look at all of the Sustainable Development Goals, and we're 13th out of 15 on environmental indicators. And while the budget made some initiatives that will make some small impact, for example, the carbon issue, it's not on the scale that is required to make a substantial difference. And I wouldn't be surprised if the actual netting outcome doesn't move Ireland substantially up that table, if you like. I want to move on to the previous page, page 22. And I suppose we have we try to list as we go the progress on policy proposals that we're making. It's very important as we're making policy proposals that we should recognise if we're making progress on them. Now, what we do here is some of these are progress made in this particular budget, and some of them are ones that are more long-ranging and long-term, and they're progress we're making over a period of time. If one of the ones that we consider to be important over a period of time is that 3-4 years ago, with the new government and the programme for government and so on, there was a kind of looking at public services and infrastructure versus tax cuts, and they were going to have certain proportions in there. And we were arguing that the proportions were wrong because they were giving too high a proportion to tax cuts and tax breaks and not enough to infrastructure and social services. What we find in this is that this is actually levelled out towards our proposals, if you like, and we welcome that, because now we have a situation where the importance of public services and infrastructure is recognised more. We recognise in this particular budget the job seeker rates under 26 has come down. It's only come down 1 year, but at least it's progress in the right direction. Still a long way to go. Carbon tax, as has been pointed out already, we looked for 10 euro of an increase per tonne. The 6 euro is positive, although we would be negative about the lack of mitigation and the lack of a just transition on the scale required to deal with this. We're always very concerned about policy initiatives that put the cost in at the beginning and then promise to deliver mitigation and just transitions and so on in due course. But in actual fact, a lot of the time, they don't actually measure up. There's a number of others that have been that we've had some progress in. I'm not going to actually go through them all there because I want to go back to the front, if you like, back to the editorial on page one. And just to summarise all the analysis and critique, I think the headline says it all. The budget betrays the vulnerable, and we use those words advisedly. Many people will find themselves further behind, particularly people who are poor, people on the margin, people who are the most vulnerable in society will find themselves further behind as a result of this particular budget. The cost of living increase is not being dealt with. The cost of living increase has not been provided for. Many of them have received no increases whatsoever. On top of the cost of living will come other issues, such as the cost of food that I pointed out already. And another one that I've heard nobody mention, but the public transport costs are actually going to go up. You have a situation where the cost of fuel is going up. Bus Éireann and Bus Eol Cliath and the various bus companies, they will have to pay for the increases, but they're not getting any additional subsidy from government to cover those costs. So in effect, to balance their books, they're going to have to put up the fares, which are already pretty high. So additional costs, as well as the cost of living that's projected, we will see additional increases in food costs and public transport, and there are other issues as well. So the situation is pretty clear. Vulnerable people will see their standard of living fall and they'll slip further behind, even further behind than they currently are, the rest of society. This is not acceptable. On the night before the budget, the Taoiseach went on television and he said that this would be a social justice budget. However, there is very little evidence to support this claim. We would challenge the Taoiseach to indicate how he could justify that in a budget that basically leaves a great many of the vulnerable further behind than when they started in it. Now, in terms of Brexit, we've mentioned already, we welcome the allocation of resources, but we regret the lack of focus on the vulnerable in this context. The cost of living is an issue that we've been talking about. There's a couple of other things that we want to just put into this equation. People might have wondered, why were we insisting on a 9 euro and arguing for a 9 euro a week increase in welfare rates? And that is basically to bring those rates back to where they were, which is 27.5% of average earnings, which is not a high number by any standards. But they have slipped 9 euro behind that. Now, when you think about it, after the crash, they were at 27.5%. And to find that, despite all the recovery since the crash, that they now find themselves that bit behind is just not good enough. And it's a number that could have been put in place. We could certainly have seen that in yesterday's budget. And in our analysis and stuff beforehand, we actually showed how that could be the case. There's one other piece to put into the picture, and that is that salaries are expected to increase by an average of about 3% this year. So people with a job may say that they got nothing in the budget or whatever. That's true. But their salaries will actually increase by about 3% because they, some of them will get pay increases, some of them will get increments, and these will actually mean that they get increases of about 3% on their income during the year. There is no comparable increase for people on social welfare. And the result is that the people who lost out on the budget are not going to be able to have see increases in their income using anything that's out there. On the housing issue, I think the point that highlighted by Colette is critically important. We have a situation that is just totally unacceptable, that the scale of response is not anywhere remotely close to the level it should be at. Minister Murphy, I'm noting it here on my own computer here, my laptop, Minister Murphy is currently in a press conference lauding all the tremendous things that they're doing. But in actual fact, the scale of what they're doing is nowhere near what's required to deal with this issue. And we're going to be left with a crisis that is worse at the end of their term of office than it was when they began. And that is a serious indictment of a government that had very substantial resources available, but seemed to spend more of it in propping up landlords and promoting the private sector than in actual fact dealing with the shortage of social housing in particular. On climate and environment, we've basically made the point that that it isn't up to what it should be. We welcome the various initiatives that are there. But the minister said in his speech that bold and new decisions were required to meet the defining challenge of climate. And I don't see evidence of that really in the budget. Some of this, of the recommendations are positive. Obviously, they are, some of the decisions are positive. The Midlands Fund is welcome. But again, we'd point out that has to be replicated in other areas as well. The Midlands, the fund is not huge. It will make some, will have some impact, but it needs to be replicated across the country. The issue, I suppose, that one of the issues that we would point to again is that the gap is widening in the poverty situation, and that with the situation that we find ourselves in now, that the likelihood, it is certain that Ireland's most vulnerable will fall further behind the rest of society as a result of budget 2020 and the decisions taken there. The low total tax take is not sustainable. This is critically important. We've been arguing this for a long time. Ireland has one of the lowest total tax take takes in the European Union, and we need to deal with that. Examples of what he could have done. For example, in corporate taxation, there are a recent study by the Controller and Auditor General shows that eight of the largest companies in the country pay zero or less tax. We leave you work out how they can pay less than zero, which is true, actually. They actually get rebates for stuff like refundable tax credits, which is very interesting. But the reality is eight of the top 100 corporate taxpayers pay no corporate tax at all. Five pay under 1%. Another five pay less than 1%. One other pays between 1 and 5, and seven pay between 5 and 10. So what we're talking about is quite a substantial number of the largest corporations are not paying even a basic level. They're paying nowhere near the 12.5% and as the tax, corporate tax. And as we see, some of them pay no tax, no corporate tax at all. So what we've been arguing for is the introduction of a minimum effective corporate tax rate, suggesting it should be 6%. If there were a minimum effective corporate tax rate of 6%, it would catch all the ones that are dodging or escaping there. It could have been done in the budget. It wouldn't have had any substantial impact, I don't think, negative impact, but it would have had a very substantial impact on the income that would be available to the country. And I think it's about time that the corporate sector recognised that while many of the corporate sector pay a fair share of taxation, there are some of the real big players who don't. and they need to be tackled in this context. Another example is the one that Eamon dealt with, which is the issue of tax expenditures and the fact that somewhere in the region of about $4 billion a year is given in tax breaks, and these are not reviewed regularly, many of them. Some of them haven't been ever reviewed. And what we've been arguing is that with the budget, the government should actually publish a full list of all tax breaks, what they're costing, and basically they should be under review in the same way that the rest of the money that the government is spending each year is also under review. The issue of transparency is a critical issue. We again point out that the numbers available in the budget documentation are becoming less and less. There is less information in this year's budget documentation than has been the case for many years. And you can identify that by the number of press conferences that are being held today, where pieces of the budget are being explained by particular ministers. That detail is not contained in the budget documentation when it used to be contained in the past. So we have a very interesting situation in which it is difficult to critique the budget when the government hides the numbers. If you wanted to find a particular department that you wanted to go and take a serious look at, health would be the obvious one, because we do not believe that it is possible to meet the existing level of service in the health budget, plus all of the initiatives that have been announced with the budget that has been provided. In practice, that will mean that the new initiatives will be taken, but there will be cuts in the existing level of service, and those cuts are being hidden and have not been announced by government in the budget. And that is not a proper way to do a budget. It certainly isn't transparent. So we would argue very strongly for transparency in the budget. Overall, I think you've got a fairly clear picture of where we are and what our view is. One final point. If a hard Brexit emerges, there is an unavoidable need for a supplementary budget to ensure the vulnerable are protected from its inevitable impact. The Minister for Finance and the Taoiseach have gone to great lengths saying they will not have a supplementary budget. Now, what we're simply saying is a supplementary budget must be put in place to protect the vulnerable who will be hit by the hard Brexit when it comes. And it is not acceptable under any circumstance that government leave those who are the weakest and most vulnerable, to leave them for a full year suffering from the further losses imposed by Brexit simply because they have not been provided for in the budget. The reality is that the budget betrays the vulnerable. Many are left further behind. Thank you. Questions?
We hope you have enjoyed our podcast. Until next time, thank you for listening.